Welcome, everybody. My pleasure to move us on to our next session. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. John Koff. Dr. Chan is an associate research scientist in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale University. He's known for his work in phage therapy, exploiting genetic trade-offs to treat antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections. His work spans the entire bench to bedside spectrum, and he has successfully isolated, characterized, and used bacteriophages to treat several infections. Featured in the Netflix series, Follow This, his research has reinvigorated phage therapy in Western medicine. Dr. Koff completed fellowship training in pulmonary and critical care medicine at UC San Francisco, where he went on to become the associate director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program and member of the Lung Transplantation Program. Dr. Koff joined the faculty at Yale University in 2011 to direct the Adult CF Program and to continue his research that focuses on pulmonary immunology. We welcome Dr. Chan and Dr. Koff as they present Advances in Phage Therapy as a Treatment for Cystic Fibrosis.
Cool. Thanks for having us and for the very kind intro. I'm Ben, and John and I are going to split this talk. So I guess you get me for the first two-thirds of this. So I just thought for my bit, we'd talk about the Phage Center here at Yale, the Center at Yale for Phage Biology and Therapy, which is, I guess this is more or less a unofficial announcement of our like opening, where we cover sort of the basic translational and clinical bits of phage therapy. So like I said, we have three parts: discovery, development, and deployment of bacteriophage-based therapies, starting in the pond, sewer, water, whatever, where we isolate bacteriophages, we bring those to the lab and study them at the bench to characterize them and hopefully prepare some of them for clinical use. And then we use them in the clinic here and in other places. And then we sort of bring them back to the bench and tweak them with patient samples, with see what worked, what didn't work, different nebulizers. So that's basically the whole center. And so today I'll talk to you guys for about 20 minutes or so on the first two parts of this, and then I'll hand it over to John and he'll talk about the cool clinical stuff. So at the center we do, like I said, these three parts: isolation, characterization, clinical potential is what we do in the beginning with first fresh phages we pull out of the environment. But before I can talk about sort of the discovery side, I thought I'd just talk about phages really briefly so that we're all on the same page or whatever. So bacteriophages, as you'll probably hear later in some of the other talks, are the most numerous life forms on Earth. There are maybe 10 to the 31st of them on the planet, but they definitely outnumber bacteria. And they were discovered about 100 years ago by a couple of people, Felix Durrell and Torp. And here's just a quick, cartoon illustrating some of the diversity of these phages. This is, it looks like maybe 150, 200 of the phages from our library that we sequenced. They span all sorts of different families, and we have several new genera described. I thought I'd cover the life cycle. And so this blue little Sputnik looking probe thing is a bacteriophage, an illustration of one. And the green oval is supposed to represent a bacteria. The first step in their life cycle is to attach to the host, in this case, bacteria. And then they inject their nucleic acid. They make copies of it. They make new parts to assemble phages, and they assemble the phage particles, throw DNA in. And then the last step, they burst, and each of these phage particles goes on to find a new bacterial host to repeat the cycle. So we study a lot of the first bit, the attachment here in the lab. And it's actually, kind of complicated. It's not just as simple as just like sticking necessarily, in that the phage has to recognize a particular receptor or receptors on the surface of a bacteria. And these surface receptors are like sugars, proteins, fat, something that can be recognized. And they're not present on all members of a genus. And even within a species, often we have, you know, just one very specific isolate is sensitive to a particular phage. So the bacteriophage bounces around in the environment until it bumps into one of these receptors that it's the proper one, it sticks to it and starts the infectious process, right? So this means that bacteriophages are extremely specific to what types of bacteria they can infect. And historically, I think this was viewed negatively and that you'd have to throw, you know, hundreds of different bacteriophages into a cocktail in order to make it a viable product that's able to actually have any spectrum of activity. However, I think recently, as we're, you know, appreciating the microbiome a lot more, I think it's becoming more of one of the good aspects of bacteriophage. And I hope to, you know, further convince you of that here today. So if you think of, you know, a closed system of a bacteria and bacteriophage in a cycle where the phages are infecting and reproducing, eventually life sort of finds a way and the bacteria, you know, as a community, will evolve away from sensitivity to the bacteriophage. And here at the Phage Center, we are hoping that we can direct this evolutionary response to reduce or reverse antibiotic resistance and or attenuate virulence. And we think of it as sort of a spectrum here, where on the left, we have a really virulent or you know, a bacteria that's highly resistant to antibiotics. And then over here on the right, resistant to phage. And then over here on the right, we have something that's totally resistant to phage, and with attenuated virulence, right? So it's like it's a trade-off along a spectrum here. And different strains will be in different positions, but we hope to sort of play with the spectrum here to improve, you know, outcomes in people. And so our take on this is more like a phage therapy sort of 2.0, because we're basically trying to design therapeutics that work with antibiotics or the immune system. And we're focusing really specifically on a lot of these factors involved in virulence and antibiotic resistance. So for example, you know, if you just throw a bunch of penicillin at something, it might result in increased beta lactamase production, right? Which isn't necessarily very helpful for the person that's now full of antibiotic resistant bacteria. But in the phage therapy case, we're working on like targeting very specific things, you know, like you know, motility or biofilm production. And so maybe the bacteria are, you know, less motile, they can't biofilms, or they have increased antibiotic sensitivity, something that we could actually benefit off in a trade-off. Okay. So now to the first bit here. Let me just quadruple check the time because I don't want to go over. The first step is isolation in phage therapy, characterization of phages. And, you know, finding phages is pretty easy because, like I said, they're the most numerous organism on the planet. But finding like the right one or good ones for therapeutic development is a little bit less simple. But it, at least in our group, it starts all the same way. And we get a water sample from, you know, sewage, pond, lake, compost, ditch, whatever. We then do what's an enrichment. Same process has been done for, you know, decades in biology here. And we actually expose that water sample to, you know, a strain of bacteria. And several of these here on the list are obviously CF relevant and many others less so. But we then use that to grow. And so whatever phage can infect that strain will multiply. We purify the phages from those samples, you know, and many of them don't pass this step because they're like not stable or whatever. Once we have a pure culture of the phage that's stable enough, we try to identify its receptor that we talked about earlier. And through, you know, infecting a bunch of transposon knockouts or some of these other high throughput techniques we've developed. From there, we do the genome once we have a good one. And then that, you know, uses a receptor that is meaningful clinically. We sequence the phage and then we exclude some of these phages that have genes that are maybe undesirable, like temperate phage, and then those that are able to, that are carrying, you know, some other undesired gene. So from there, we characterize the phages even further. We generate what's called like a lytic spectrum or a lytic table, where we determine the phage's ability to infect and kill a panel of bacteria. So in this case, this is just an illustration of 100 or so Pseudomonas aeruginosis lists that were kindly provided by the CF Foundation. And then several phages here where the green, so each column is a bacteria and each row is a phage. And then it's basically testing the sensitivity and resistance of each of these strains to sort of show how broad spectrum, I guess, a particular phage is on a relevant panel of bacteria. Okay, so we have all that like basic, you know, discovery information on these phages, and then we start trying to develop them into, you know, medicine, really. And so to do that, you know, some of the critical parts we do are mutational spectrum of resistance, which we'll get to, cross resistance, and we try to optimize them for treatment. But before we get there, we just got to be extra careful because we have examples in the lab, fortunately not in person yet, because I think hopefully we did sufficient characterization before it ends up in a person, but where we have a bacteria that's phage sensitive and virulent, but after exposure to phage and then evolved resistance, you actually get it to be phage resistant and like actually extra virulent or increased antibiotic sensitivity. So we just need to be extra careful in developing these phages to make sure we're doing the right thing, okay? All right, so back to the lytic table here, we try to determine the mutational spectrum of resistance. And to do that in the simplest way, let's just look at these three phages here, TPH6, 27, and 01. So, you know, this is just the data reformatted in that TPH6 killed 76 out of 100 of these isolates, 27 killed 65, and then 01 here on the right killed 77 of them, right? And so they're named TIVP something, because of our naming convention in the lab is we try to name it after what we believe to be the receptor binding site. So in this case, all three of these phages use the type 4 pilus, which is used in motility in Pseudomonas. So anyway, so we have these three phages. We then sequence all the green boxes here. So all the strains that are sensitive to these phages, we deep sequence those. We also expose these strains to the phage. And then we took five independent replicates and then we sequenced all those. So we have five replicates for resistant mutants for randomly selected resistant mutants to each of these strains. So 5 × 76, 5 × 65, 5 × 77. We sequence them all and then we take the data that comes out of the sequencers, run it through Python scripts, and then we, you know, get rid of the bad reads. And then we remove the alignments to the phage sensitive ancestor. So what we're doing is we're looking for reads that are different in the evolved resistant strains. And then, you know, we find out where those reads align to the genome, and we quantify the number of mutations per nucleotide, per gene, per pathway to generate a heat map, which we'll see here in a second. But it's like a really big heat map and maybe not the most informative, right? So in this table, in the columns, we have different phage resistant strains. And then the rows are different genes of Pseudomonas. And the intensity of red is the number of mutations in that gene. Okay, so the brighter red, the more mutations. And so you get, you know, across the whole Pseudomonas aeruginosa genome, you get like a pretty big panel here. And so, you know, manually going through and looking through this is not going to be very helpful. So we needed a way to make this sort of more meaningful. And to do that, we basically just did some statistics, right? So you compare the number of hits per gene per pathway and try to reduce the number of false negatives and correct for, you know, random mutation, or sorry, the sequencing error rate. And then once you do that, it actually comes out to be a lot cleaner. And in this case, things distilled into, you know, four-ish genes, all in the same group. So most of the strains had mutations in PIL-L, which is one of these pilus genes. And then there was one here at the right, which surprisingly did not have mutations there, significant accumulation mutations there, but it did have it in these other type 4 pilus genes. So it's really nice to us to know that, you know, if you use a phage that targets a type 4 pilus, the bacteria that evolve resistance actually come out, you know, with mutations in the pilus. So that's, I mean, it sounds a little bit stupid, I realize, but it's just, it's nice to know that what we put in causes a more predictable effect. Okay, so then I guess another question we often get is it better to use cocktails or series of phages? The standard before was to use cocktails, but we've obviously done some experiments to try and see, which one is maybe better. And so to do this cocktail versus sequential work, we tested this in a lab strain of E. coli, actually, because we have a really well-characterized E. coli strain. That's, every single gene, we know all the, not we, but scientific community, everybody knows what all these genes do. So it was a really good model system. And we tested with four different phage here that we've characterized fairly well in the lab that have known receptors and genomes and everything. So we use one that uses a type 6 receptor. So it's like a nuclear outer membrane TSX. One uses TOLC, which is an antibiotic efflux protein, OMP-A, which is a, maybe a virulence factor. And then another one uses a cell wall of E. coli. And we designed a series of experiments to test, the effects of single phage in sequence versus a whole cocktail. And that was designed as follows. We had a control population that we split into four and exposed it to one of the four phages, allow, evolution to happen and resistance to occur. We then exposed those populations to the remaining three phages that hadn't seen before. And then from there, we allowed it to evolve resistance. And then we collected and we exposed it to two more phages separately. And then we exposed it to the final phage. And at each time point, we collected the population, sequenced it, and looked at the phenotypes. We tested antibiotic sensitivity and then sensitivity to all the other phages. We did this also with each of the possible phage combinations, a two phage, three phage, and four phage cocktail. And then we did a control where we just serially passaged the bacteria without exposure to the phage, just to make sure that, we could control for drift. And then we did this actually in triplicate with three independent populations. And we also did it with this standard lab strain and then a mutator strain. But just to simplify, we'll just talk about one group here. And so one of the first things that we noticed straight away in doing the phenotype assays was that mucoidy evolves quickly, right? It just, you can tell when you look at them, they're really extra goopy. And then also comes out in the sequencing. You can see which genes are involved. So we looked at this mucoidy and it's associated with T7 exposure, which is this phage that uses the deep part of the cell wall. We also found that exposure to cocktail, independent of whether T7 was actually in it. So in some of the two phage and three phage cocktails where T7 wasn't present, we also got mucoidy to evolve. And it's also associated with cross resistance, right? So in the case where it was exposed only to phage T7, say, and it evolved mucoidy as a resistance mechanism, it actually ends up that it's resistant now that it's mucoid to the other phages involved, which is not very good, right? So why mucoidy? Well, if you look at the bacteria and here's some of the receptors, it's possible that this capsule that forms covers the receptor binding sites of these phage or some other way makes it difficult for the phages to dig in there and find the receptor. So if that's the case, are all strains destined to become mucoid, especially if you're gonna use phage therapy? And I think at least in the case of E. coli, the answer is no. And we have some good evidence in Pseudomonas as well that that's not the case, as we have a phage-based solution for this as well. So we have a phage that actually seems to encode some sort of enzyme or something that degrades the capsule. And this phage actually requires a mucoid strain to infect. So basically, if you're mucoid and E. coli, you're probably sensitive to this phage. This phage, when you expose the bacteria to it, it basically, the bacteria evolves resistance quickly, but at the cost of not being mucoid anymore. And then once it loses the mucoidy, it's actually resensitized to all these other phages that we used in the beginning. And so we're obviously, continuing to study this. We have a lot more work to do there, because it's actually kind of a big study. But we've got quite a bit, and we're just looking at the last bit with throwing in this mucoid-dependent phage. Okay, so then when we looked at sequencing, so we sequenced each of these populations at every time point, right? So we crunched that through the computer and we looked at what we're calling off-target and on-target mutations, where on-target mutations would be the mutations associated with the receptor binding site, right? And so when you just use a single phage, in series, we ended up with 60-something percent of the mutations were actually predictable in the receptor binding site locations, with remaining 37% elsewhere. And then when you, that number goes way down when you pair them or put triples or phage cocktails together, it looks like it's way less predictable in how the bacterial population responds, at least in the system, in the way that we tested it. So so I guess this may be, for us at least, would suggest that maybe a series of use of phages might be beneficial, right? So when we did the same as before with looking at the statistics of it, in a similar table here, the receptor genes in the single phage exposed seem to be the mostly significant ones, whereas the cocktails, it's pretty randomly distributed. Okay, so then, you know, how do you choose an appropriate phage course, right? So should it be cocktail, should it be sequential? I think it really depends on, you know, what's going on and what your goal is. I think if it's an acute, uncomplicated, and maybe drug resistant, and fully realize that drug resistance could be a complication, maybe a cocktail is the best way to go, in that, you know, you just need to depress the population so that the immune system can take over and finish the job, or antibiotics, right? Whereas in the sequential side, in a case that's probably more familiar, more relevant in the CF case, where it's a chronic infection that's complicated, maybe some bronchiectasis or something, and there's a high probability of recolonization, so that you can basically sculpt the population so that, you know, it occupies the niche still that a virulent bacteria might occupy, but it's, you know, reduced virulence or causing less tissue damage, so that when there is an exacerbation, then it could be easier to manage. So that's been our approach so far, at least in the CF space. Okay, so the next step is deployment, where we're delivering phage and testing samples and analyzing them and following up. And this is where I'm going to hand it off to John. But just real quick, we're also aware that phage don't necessarily have the best tissue penetration. And so we try to maximize the delivery of phages to the infection site. And so we're also doing a lot of work there. Anyway, so I guess now I will hand off to Dr. Koff, who can talk about the cool clinical work that we've been doing.
Well, thanks, Ben. That was fantastic as always. And so I'm going to go into much more of the clinical application. And what I would like to highlight for everyone is, which in the CF community we're very familiar with in terms of understanding antibiotic resistance, and specifically for Pseudomonas, I think, and some of our other more difficult to treat gram negatives, and certainly NTM, that an antibiotic resistance crisis is the next pandemic that we're going to be thinking about, after we deal with COVID. And the WHO highlights this for 2050. If you can see my cursor here, that this is going to be important around the world for infections as resistance to antibiotics increases with frequency and our pipeline is limited. And so that gets us to phage therapy. And quoting Sanskrit or famously Winston Churchill, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the application, as you heard from Dr. Chen or from Ben, has been worked, has been thought about since the early 1900s. But issues, I think, that are relevant for how we think about deploying phage therapy really relate to standardization and purification, which I think we have a handle on. Efficacy is going to be very important in terms of how we identify the appropriate patient and patient situation. Delivery has been alluded to, so that we get it directly into the particular tissue of interest. In the case of CF, the lungs. Nebulization, I think, comes up higher on the list, but certainly IV has been evaluated. And the treatment algorithm, which you heard from Ben about, where single sequential phage has a role compared to cocktail. And so the literature is actually getting quite robust. We have these single cases. This case from Nature Medicine using a cocktail of phages to treat Mycobacterium abscessus or non-tuberculous mycobacterium in a CF patient post lung transplant was a fantastic story of success. And you can see that some other relevant cases have been described for cystic fibrosis in terms of patients receiving treatment before or after transplant, and then also focusing on the sinuses. And this is a great summary by Dwayne Roach and his group, looking at all of the available reports in the literature using phage therapy, as you can see here, from 2005 to 2020, with a focus on compassionate use and clinical trials. For our part, as you heard from Ben, we are focusing on, especially for this talk, on CF patients who are in the outpatient setting. And we typically were nebulizing phage from 7 to 10 days. We did a series of studies to show that changing how air is circulated in the room for negative pressure is not required. And that allows for us to do this in more of our standard patient rooms. And from an outcome perspective, we're going to collect sputum and we're going to follow these patients clinically. And on the right, you can see examples of Ben here with the first CF patient being treated with nebulized phage, and the both of us in our clinic at Yale, also doing treatment. We obviously got permission from these individuals to show these pictures. So far, we have one graft treated that was published by Ben and his group. We have two patients with non-CF bronchiectasis who received inhaled phage. This list is actually increasing currently. And we have 12 patients, 11 with Pseudomonas, one with Acromobacter. This list is actually also larger as of 2 weeks ago. So this process continues. And when we report out the patients, you can see here just trying to put together a list where the non-CF bronchiectasis patients are older. We have many more women than men with CF who have pan-drug resistant or multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas. You can see here the phages that we used, and I'll talk to you about the impact and the trade-off. So the most important impact that Ben wanted to measure, and we all want to measure, is whether or not we're getting a decrease in the amount of bacteria in the sputum from our patients after treatment. And so here we're measuring the sputum produced by our patients after phage therapy. And we're looking at a time point that's about a week after they finished the phage therapy. And you can see that we see this significant decrease in the CFUs per ml. That's about a log and a half, which is consistent with what you see with IV antibiotics and studies for inhaled antibiotics. But obviously those types of studies have been done in a larger population of patients. But the fantastic thing that we also saw, which really highlighted our interest about pursuing this in the CF community, is that there was an increase in lung function for the individuals that were treated. And on the right, we're showing you that this increase in lung function really cuts off dependent on what the baseline lung function is for the individuals that are treated. So if you're above 30 or 40% predicted, you seem to have a bigger response. And below that number, you seem to have a smaller response. Having said that, with the individuals with lung function below 30% who received phage therapy, you know, and had an improvement in, you know, you can see there two of them of 5% predicted, you know, thought that that was pretty meaningful. And you could argue that that's pretty meaningful for what we see even with medications like Trikafta, where a small amount of improvement in lung function may be occurring with the lower FEV1 starting point. But also the consideration that maybe there's an effect on the Pseudomonas and lung inflammation, which I'll get to in a second, that could be impacting the patients above the 30% predicted, really drove our interest in looking at this in a clinical trial. And the trade-off that you heard about from previously is also occurring. So in individuals who had, and in this case had pan-drug resistant and multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas, and to take a step back, all of this was done through an FDA emergent IND mechanism to get approval from the FDA and approval from our IRBs in order for us to initiate it. So not surprising that these were multi-drug resistant and pan-drug resistant Pseudomonas that we're treating. But it was really exciting to see that when we target the receptor for the phage to bind, that's called, it's an efflux pump, which is essentially a mechanism for the bacteria to push out antibiotics from inside the cell, that after treatment, you would see a change. And so pre-treatment is in blue, post-treatment is in red. So there was resistance to aminoglycosides like tobramycin prior to treatment, and that decreased dramatically. We saw the same thing for the beta-lactam. So we test for ceftazidime zosyn, and then ceftazidime for the cephalosporins. However, there's no change in the fluoroquinolones, which isn't that surprising when we talk to when I talk to Ben and our other experts in Pseudomonas because of the mechanism for fluoroquinolone resistance. But this also allows for us to think about how to understand inflammation. And in these experiments that I'm describing for you, we really focused on using airway epithelial cells and mouse models to see if we could understand the amount of inflammation that's being generated in response to the phage. And the hypothesis is that if we target particular receptors on the Pseudomonas, we may see a decrease in that. And so this is a cartoon just showing you that we have sputum before phage therapy and afterwards. We then isolate the Pseudomonas, culture them up, collect their supernatants. So this is the junk that the Pseudomonas is making on top of those cells that would be produced in the lung in addition to the bacteria being there. We collect those supernatants and we then put them into the lungs of the mice or on epithelial cells that are airway epithelial cells that are grown in culture. And I'm going to kind of go through this quickly, but the basic concept is that there's evidence for the trade-off to also suggest decrease in inflammation. So this, again, pre-phage and post-phage, you can see a change from the green to this yellow color. And this is actually one of the things that Ben picked out to find a phage that would make this happen. And we found that pyocyanin, which is a dye, so it's a green dye, was mediating this effect. So pre-phage, you see it's high. Post-phage, it goes down, and it goes down as we continue to treat individuals. And pyocyanin is associated with inflammation and a bunch of activating factors in the lung, like mucus secretion and others that lead to inflammation and pathology that you could imagine could be happening in CF. So this is a busy slide, but the point is that when we put the supernatants on the epithelial cells or into the mouse, we see a change in the signal between pre and post phage that suggests that there's a decrease in inflammation that's occurring. So we so far have given phage to individuals without evidence of significant side effects. Individuals are tolerating the inhalation of phage. We've been able to see a trade-off, as I mentioned, whether it's antibiotic sensitivity or decreased inflammation. We're able to do this with help from the FDA to get approval and obviously from our local IRBs at our different institutions. And we think we have an effective dosing regimen that we have identified in the different parts of the hospital. If someone's really sick in the ICU or if they're on the hospital floor, or as I showed you in the outpatient setting. There's a potential for personalized medicine. We think about how the patient is doing. Do they have a lot of inflammation? Do they have Pseudomonas that's multi-drug resistant? What are our goals here? And can we address them with phage? And we have evidence that we can retreat the same individual without seeing any type of toxicity. And ongoing studies are going to look at whether or not there are antibodies developed or whether or not we see an effect from the phage. And so I think it's worth noting that while there's a lot of literature, especially from the Tbilisi, the phage program in Tbilisi, Georgia, the country of Georgia, and there's a lot of patients who've previously been treated. We clearly need additional clinical trials to make sure that we identify the safety and efficacy that we've talked about. We favor delivery through nebulization to directly get it into the CF lung. Ben's described to you the strategy where we know that phage resistance will occur. So the bacteria are going to, especially Pseudomonas, will evolve resistance. But in doing so, we have a strategy to manipulate them so they're less inflammatory or we introduce increased susceptibility to antibiotics. You can see we highlighted an approach where single phage may work well in the CF community and that longitudinal treatment may be a goal for us. The regulatory piece in terms of how the FDA is going to treat phage therapy is an unknown. And obviously there are a lot of conversations going on about that. And we're very interested to see how that's going to develop. That prompted us to look into a study for that we call SciFi at Yale, which is a single center study looking at phage versus placebo for safety and the effect on Pseudomonas. And I'm gonna just summarize here that this study is ongoing. If there's any interest, to please reach out to us. We now have a mechanism to bring patients to Yale for this type of study through funding from internally at Yale and also from the CF Foundation. We also have additional phage studies in CF going on, and these are some of them that I'm aware of, and it's very exciting to see these because it will help address the question about the effect and the efficacy of cocktails and also IV administration of phage. And at Yale, we're certainly looking at continuing to try and treat individuals while these studies are going on, expanding our library, in particular targeting Burkholderia. And we have a fantastic phage that Ben has identified for MRSA, MRSA, that we're very excited to think about using and developing for a clinical trial. And with that, Ben and I certainly want to thank all of our patients and their families, the phage program, folks in my lab, the adult CF program, and our funders. And with that, we'll take any questions.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Chan and Dr. Koff. There we go. great talk. And now we'll take some questions from our audience. Siri?
Hello, yes, I echo just incredible amount of information. So fascinating. Now, some of them, I see Dr. Chan has been wonderfully answering things in the chat box, but a key question somebody had asked about how to access those clinical trials and what is the eligibility for the trials?
That's a great question. And I think, I can't see the chat on mine. So I'll try and help out with those questions. There are several trials, so it really depends on the specific trial. For the vast majority of them, we're looking at individuals who have Pseudomonas in their sputum, whose lung function is above 40% predicted, or some of them require a higher baseline. Some of them also top out at 100%, others do not, and a stable disease, right? So that there are no new medications introduced. If you're recently on modulators, you need to wait a certain amount of time, and no recent exacerbations and no recent participation in clinical trials. So all of those are kind of the common requirements. But we can get into the specifics. You can communicate with myself or Claire Cochran is at Yale as our research coordinator, but also your local CF program will be able to tell you about the existing studies that are going on through the TDN, which is obviously the CF Foundation's Therapeutic Development Network. The program, the study at Yale is not part of the TDN, so please reach out to me specifically for that and I can provide that information.
Thank you. And we had a question, does it matter if the Pseudomonas is mucoid or non-mucoid? Is there a difference for eligibility?
No, there's no difference. The vast majority of these treatments are looking for individuals who are, you know, colonized with Pseudomonas, have had Pseudomonas for an extended period of time. I would expect that to be mucoid in our CF patients, but if it has not been characterized that way, that won't change the inclusion. I think Ben and I would be very interested in some of those samples if it wasn't mucoid so that we could study this, because that would be very helpful information.
And I know, Dr. Chan, you answered in the chat, but for those who aren't keeping up with that, there were questions about what other pathogens are being addressed with this therapy.
Sure. Yeah, sorry, I'm trying to multitask with the chat. So we're looking at tons of bacteria, really. So definitely Pseudomonas, obviously, staph. We have phages for Klebsiella, E. coli, Citrobacter, Serratia, Stenotrophomonas, Acinetobacter, Acromobacter. I guess that's unless and most of the big ones for CF. I might have missed one, but if I did, we probably have phage for it. I don't know.
Thank you. Let's see. Mara asks, seems that pan resistance in women is higher. Is there anything that would indicate women would respond to phage therapy differently as well? Can the gender difference be modeled in the mice studies?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think before we go to that step, that's really a little bit of a sampling issue for us in terms of how people were made aware and the individuals that did approach us for phage therapy. But if we do see that type of effect more broadly, then I think it absolutely can be modeled. There are obviously limitations to the mouse. It's a great model for exactly what you're describing, but its lack of ability to kind of develop bronchiectasis and the clinical correlate to human disease makes it harder to keep the bacterium phage alive in the CF lung without the mouse clearing it. And so that is something that we are thinking about modeling more in vitro and using other cell systems, but it may be a great example of something that needs to be done in some of these larger animal models so that we can get an answer at that. That's a great question.
We have requests for your slides. Is it possible to make those available to attendees or no?
So we would love to. There is some data on this that is unpublished. So I think Ben and I would need to just go over that and then we can provide it to CFRI and they can disseminate it, but I would like to remove the kind of proprietary information if that's okay with everyone.
Very well understood. We had a question from Gabriella about negative side effects from this therapy.
Yeah, that's a great question, really important. So the studies will get at that, obviously. The most common issue that individuals have mentioned when they receive phage is about 48 to 72 hours, a little bit longer, depending on the individual, is increased fatigue, feeling like there's some ongoing inflammation has been described to me. One patient initially early on described that it feels like what happens when you have antibiotics that are working, quote unquote, and that's been repeated actually for three other patients. So I think that is a common theme. Low grade temperatures have been described. No one has actually had a true temperature. And there has been no problem with the inhalation, but that's something that's being discussed. And there is a potential with the FDA has asked us to monitor liver function tests. I think that's from data from IV therapy that the liver function testing might change over time. But that obviously happens with our CF patients. We have not seen that with inhaled therapy. And so so we are following all of these things very carefully, but we're in the study. We are monitoring patients very closely, asking them to record a diary. And so we're looking to make sure that we do not miss additional side effects. But that's why these studies need to be done to identify the safety and ensure that we're not missing something that could be detrimental. I think one thing that's always asked about is whether or not treating Pseudomonas with the phage is leading to other bacteria becoming problematic. And our first pass at this from the patients that I described to you is that is not the case. We see a decrease in Pseudomonas, but it's not as if staph or MRSA comes up and becomes a huge pathogen or fungus or something else. We are not seeing that. But again, we're looking at data from 7 to 12 patients, and we need a much larger data set to confirm that that's not an issue.
And Dr. Chan, I know you mentioned many of the pathogens, but there are still more coming in. Two things, one about whether there are any clinical trials for NTM to be treated, and then somebody who's also worried about fungus, C. auris.
Yeah, sure. So for NTM, I don't know about trial, maybe John could chime in there, but there's definitely compassionate cases that have been treated for NTM in CF. And, you know, if it's the guy that's really leading that is named Graham Hadfull. He's at Pittsburgh. But obviously, if someone emails us, we can connect whoever to whoever. And then fungus, unfortunately, no, we don't have any biological tool there. We can only deal with bacteria.
Yes, so I'm not aware of a clinical trial for NTM. I know that Graham and his group are actively supporting compassionate use cases, which is what we have done. We are discussing at the North American CF conference a case of NTM being treated by phage, and I'm going to be a discussant for that. So we will be, I know there'll be at least one case presented, but I agree with Ben. We don't have that information, but we can connect anyone to Dr. Hadfull and his group. I know there's a lot of interest, but I think the ongoing studies in NTM may have to be a little bit better developed for us to then know where we could insert phage into that algorithm. And there's also a significant concern, not concern, but there's a challenge in the NTM phage discovery where it requires looking for many and many phages on the order of thousands often to find one that's going to work for a particular NTM strain. So there are some challenges inherent in that disease.
Well, we've gone over time, but there's one last question that many people are interested in. So I'll ask that one last question of you both from Beata Illich. How can the phage permeate the airway mucus?
I wrote a brief response in there. There are two mechanisms that we think are happening. One is there's the potential for phage to survive on the mucus, kind of waiting for bacteria to escape kind of the biofilm. The second is actually phage, when they're produced, do have some enzymes that have some kind of mucus penetrating properties. And I believe those are actually being considered in as potential therapeutic options, and that has been studied. I'm not sure, Ben, do you have any other comments on that mechanism?
No, that covers it. And I think I put one answer in the chat somewhere, but yeah, that's